Hello and welcome to If Anyone Cares. My name is Riley James. Thank you so much for listening to the show. I cannot appreciate your time enough. This is episode 117 of the podcast. And today we finally get to an industry that we have not touched on really at all. And that is the gaming industry. Today's guest is Robert Bowling. You may know him as one of the people at Infinity Ward that made the Call of Duty Modern Warfare series, the original set of games from 2006 to 2012. Games that have still held up over the course of time. Games that I currently own and I'm looking at right now that are in our office set up over here. It's been a part of my childhood to play those games through my teenage years and now until my adulthood. The fact that he had a hand in those games and the development process and in getting them out to folks like me to be able to enjoy for years and years to come. Really appreciated him talking about that time in his life. And then what happened after? Why would you leave such a successful franchise to go and do a bunch of other things? We talk about art versus commerce as well as his new gaming studio, Midnight Society, and their game in production right now, Dead Drop, which has a very interesting way of going through the development process. And Robert, very open about that. You can play the game as it's being developed. That's a wild concept. He deep dive into that whole thing later in the program. But I cannot appreciate his time enough. The first time I reached out to Robert was 2017. We had a show planned for 2018. Obviously didn't happen. Now it's 2024. I was scrolling through some old DMs looking for show ideas, maybe reignite a conversation. And I found this one, and I'm very happy I got to do it now because I'm much better in 2024 than I was in 2018 or 2017. So the fact he came on the show, very busy man. He has a lot of followers on the internet, 500,000 on what is now formerly Twitter and X. It was a great show. He's a heck of a storyteller. And frankly, there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to get to that we just didn't. We ran out of time. And hopefully he'll come back in the program sometime later this year. We can get to all the stuff we didn't get to. And we could have a great time once again. As for the show news, this is our only show in March. We have our birthday show coming up on April 6th, 2024. That's our 7-year anniversary of this podcast. 7 years of IAC. Couldn't be more excited for that. We have a great show planned already. And then we'll be back to 2 shows a month in April. But just for scheduling reasons and so much going on this month with the start of our new show, USL, with Goals TV and some other stuff we're working on behind the scenes, we did 1 show in March. We'll go back to 2 in April and take it month by month through the summer. But thank you so much for listening to the program. I won't hold you up anymore. Contractual stuff as always. At Riley James IAC on X and Instagram. The show is available on Spotify along with show-sponsored playlists. The link is in our show description. The main show is still found on every other platform like Apple Podcasts and Rest in Peace Google Podcasts. We're available on all the other players as well, whatever one you're listening on now. Make sure to share that out to your friends that don't use Spotify or Apple because those people exist. And finally, the show art is made by the incomparable Spencer Ware, and the music is a collaboration between all good folks and IAC Productions. That is it from us. For Robert Bowling, I'm Riley James. If anyone cares, please enjoy the show. On the line from Bellevue, Washington, the studio head for Midnight Society, former creative strategist for Infinity Ward, and so many other roles all across the gaming industry, please welcome to the program, Robert Bowling. Robert, thank you so much for the time, and how are you?
I am fantastic. I'm glad we finally worked this out. I'm excited.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I was 17 years old when I started this podcast.
And 17 and 17?
Right. And I'm like, I'm just going to start just DMing people, and we'll see what happens. And you were one of the people that answered. We never got to be able to do it. And then I was scrolling through, kind of looking for some show ideas, and I found that interaction. I'm like, I'm probably a lot better at this now. He would probably have a lot more fun. This would go a lot smoother. So we're here today on March 15th of 2024. So I appreciate the time. Let's talk about you a little bit. Look, you're pretty well known within the gaming industry. I understand that lots of folks know you. A lot of folks know, especially about your time at Infinity War. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But before we talk about anything that you're actually known for, I want to start with the fact you started a business at 14 years old. I want you to tell me what the business was and what that whole thing was about.
Yeah, my first company that I started was when I was 14. So essentially, you know, I grew up in the middle of the country in Kentucky. We didn't have a lot of money. And so my dad, like, very early on was like, you know, you got to get a job. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll go get a job. So I did what you do when you're 14. You just sort of, like, get your parents to drive you around and you drop off, you know, a little resume that literally has nothing on it because you've never had a job, and you try to get a job. And I got a job at a gas station in Kentucky called In-N-Out, not like the burger chain. It was an In-N-Out gas station. It's like in between, like, it's like on the way to Erlanger, like before you get to Florence. People in Kentucky are going to get this reference, nobody else will. But it's like in between like Independence and like Erlanger in that area. In-N-Out gas station. And my job was like, you pull up, you get gas, and then you can order fried chicken from a window. And I would cook the chicken. I did that like maybe a couple days. It was hard. I hated it. I hated every single thing about it. And like, I went home and I told my dad, I was like, I can't, I'm not going to do that. And he was literally like, I don't care what you do, you just have to have a job. Like, you just have to be making money. I don't care what it is. You know, he had no sort of expectations, right? Like, there was just one goal. And I was like, all right, well, if that's all I got to do, like, I can figure something out to make money. And at that time, you know, I was really into, like, punk, ska music, still am. And I used to mail order these really cheap records and albums from a guy named Mike Park in Southern California. And Mike Park is the founder of Asian Man Records. And he, so, you know, he did all this independently. It was just him out of his parents' garage. And in the liner notes of the albums, he would write a letter that said, like, basically that, right? It's like, hey, this is an independent label. I run it out of my parents' garage. Every album sale matters. Like, thank you so much. Like, it was just a really heartfelt, genuine explanation of, like, hey, we're an indie label. This stuff matters, right? And I thought, man, if this dude can start a record label out of his parents' garage, why can't I start a record label out of my parents' trailer in Kentucky? And so I wrote Mike Park a letter, and I just said, like, hey, you know, I'm a 14-year-old kid in Kentucky. I, you know, really love your records. I want to start a record label. Is there any advice you can give me? And I included, like, a school photo from that year. Sent it off. He wrote back. It was like, you know, it literally didn't really give me any advice other than just do it, right? Like, he was basically like, if that's what you want to do, just do it. Like, I don't really know what to tell you. And it was like, it was like a genuine thing. It wasn't like a short, you know, short as in like, you know, a curt thing. It was like a, just to the point of like, yeah, just make it happen. And so I got my dad to drive me to the courthouse, and I started Classic Filth Records, which was like a punk ska indie label in Kentucky. Found out very quickly that nobody wants to buy indie punk ska records from local Kentucky bands at that time. And so, you know, our audiences were very small, wasn't making a lot of money, but I had a company. And then sort of like, and the big thing was we couldn't get anybody to cover our bands. Like, you know, the big magazines at that time, which was Rolling Stone, Spin, Alternative Press, which was the closest to our demographic. Like, nobody gave a about the bands that we were signing. And so I decided to start our own magazine, so at least then we could put our bands on the cover, and got really lucky that our buyer for our music at the time at Hot Topic had just got promoted to be in charge of music and print. So he was buying magazines and records for Hot Topic. And he had sent me an email like telling me about that promotion. And I was like, that's great, because we have a magazine. Spoiler alert, we did not have a magazine. Like, we had not made it. We had not written it. We had done nothing other than me come up with the idea of, like, man, we should have a magazine so we can put our bands on the cover. And then he's like, he's like, oh, what? That's amazing. He's like, if you can give me, excuse me, if you can give me exclusive rights to that magazine, Hot Topic exclusive rights to that magazine for the first year, we will put like X amount of copies in like every single store. And at the time, Hot Topic was huge. They had like a mall location in like every major or even, you know, slightly minor city in America at the time. And so that meant, like, I think the first check was like $30,000, which was like my dad's annual salary at the time. So for like 1 month order, it was like 30K. And it was exclusive to Hot Topic for a year. It was called Substring Music Press, and we started that. That came out of the record label. That sort of like started the whole journey into entertainment in general, which has now morphed into a lot of different things for me.
So the only there's a lot of things to pull from that. But the main thing I pulled from that is this all started because you hated cooking chicken.
Yeah. Because I was too weak to handle grease, hot grease. I was like, no, I'm out. No, thank you.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to verify that, because I very similarly hate manual labor in the sense that I got good enough at this so I don't have to, you know, sweat. Only when I want to, but no, it's amazing. So this is all happening. I imagine this probably didn't happen over the course of a year. So you're 14 when this all starts. How old were you when you moved on past this? How long was this endeavor?
No, this all started in 14. So I started the record label when I was 14. I got the job at the chicken place when I was 14. Like I said, I was only at the gas station frying chicken for like a couple days,
3 days,
maybe a week. And then went home, immediately decided I didn't want to do this. You know, over the course of a couple of weeks, got the letter back from Mike Park, started the record label, did that all the way until like I sold the magazine. I sold my half of the magazine because the record label I started by myself, the magazine I started with another friend of mine named Mark Young, who started Thriving Records in Kentucky. So they were another indie label like mine, and we started the magazine part of it together.
Okay.
And then that was all the way, that was for several years, all the way up until I sold it after I joined Infinity Ward, because like making Call of Duty was just taking, like, it was my entire life.
Right.
And I just did not have time to go scout bands, to interview bands, to listen to demos. So I just told him, I was like, man, I gotta bow out of this music stuff. And just, I sold him my half of the magazine, and then he ran it from that point on.
I'm sure your father was thrilled with the idea of his son making this, just 30 grand in, for the 1 month is absurd, but just, there's a lot of fortitude you have to have at 14 years old to like, okay, I'm going to do this and then do it. Because I was 14 once and I said stuff and that stuff didn't happen.
Right.
So to have that, the mental fortitude to be able to go and do those things, obviously there's probably some struggles. There's probably some things that didn't go your way. To push through into obviously what you have now as, you know, studio head of Midnight Society, we'll talk about that in a bit, but like that was just a indicator of what adult Robert was going to be like if you're already doing this at 14.
Yeah, you cannot underestimate how little I wanted to have a real job. Like, that has always been my greatest motivation. It's not money. It's not you know, fame. It's not any of, it's not material things. It's not sort of superficial things. It's literally my inability to take direction from anybody else. Like, that is the only motivating factor, is that I am extremely stubborn. I want to do what I want to do. Like you said, like, you don't want to sweat unless you're choosing to sweat.
Right.
Like, it's not that I'm opposed to challenging work, because in a lot of ways, the approach that I take to most things is the harder path, but it is my path, And I'd rather be on a harder path that is like made by me than walk a path that's like already cleared for me and whatever, but I have to follow somebody else's rules. Like, just something emotionally about me cannot process that.
So moving past, obviously, the business you started, you know, before you were even high school, because that's like, I can appreciate not wanting a real job more than anybody else, because I chose journalism. And sometimes it does not feel like a real job talking to strangers on the internet for an hour every couple of weeks. But you move on to, quote unquote, something that is classified as a real job. You move on to Infinity Ward. Obviously, the success of the of that company during your time there was immense. You were a part of that. What was that transition like to the gaming industry? And just to jump into something that incredible.
Yeah, it was surreal, because as you noted, I had no real world experience working at a company. So the only sort of work that I had done up until that point was like my own stuff, right? Like, I decided what I was doing every single day. Like, I decided what bands I'm working with. I decided how we're working with those bands. I decided what we're doing each day. And then moving from Kentucky, which was, you know, the only place besides a short stint as in the infantry, in the army, moving to LA was in itself like mind blowing to me, right? Because like, I grew up in the middle of the country, Piner, Kentucky, you can look it up. It has like 3,000 residents total. It's super small town. And then moving to, like, packing up whatever I had, driving out to LA, and then starting at Infinity Ward was like, I had no clue what I was supposed to do. Like, I literally went into that job having no clue how video games were made. Up until that point, I was like modding games on my own. Like, you know, I was like modding Counter-Strike, and I was like modding, you know, whatever my favorite PC game was, to just sort of like make it, like, I wouldn't say more fun, but like my kind of fun.
Yeah.
And just like tweaking stuff. So that was the extent of my video game knowledge. And I had just met, you know, some of the guys who were at, who had started Infinity Ward. And that's how we sort of like, you know, became friends. But when I got there, like, I had literally no clue what my job was supposed to be. So I spent probably the first, I want to say like several months, just going around and sitting with every single person on the team. And I think at that time, Infinity Ward was like, I want to say like 27 people, maybe a little more than that. It wasn't a huge team yet. It was definitely under 100. Maybe they were up to like 50. But I went around and like sat down with anybody I could sit down with and just try to learn what they do. Like, what does an animator do? What is their day-to-day job? What softwares do they use? What are the struggles that they hit? What does an engineer do? What does a producer do? What's an associate producer compared to a producer? What do all the individual artists do, right? There's like environment artists, there's people who model, there's people who texture, like the QA testers, like, what do they do? And I just sort of like spent months trying to figure out all of that as fast as I could. And then the plus side, I will say, of the not having any real world experiences, I had no concept of like corporate politics or like what you're supposed to do or not supposed to do and how you're supposed to talk and how you're not supposed to talk. So I was like as raw as it came, which ended up being a really big benefit, because like, I remember Activision came in for a meeting with us, because for those who don't know, like, Infinity Ward is the developer. They make the game. They make Call of Duty. And then Activision is the publisher. So they own the brand. They own the studio. But they are the publisher, which means they're in charge of, like, selling the game, distributing the game, making sure it gets in the stores, making sure people know about it, that sort of thing. And So they had come in, and Vince Zampella, who was the studio head at Infinity Ward at the time, he was executive producer and studio head in those days. He's like, oh, hey, can you go, like, meet with them? Like, they're coming in. Can you meet with them and deal with them, right? And I had no clue what that meant. Like, I had no clue what they were going to talk about. I had no clue what they wanted. I had no clue if I was going to be able to provide them answers for it. And so I went in there and just heard them out. Half they said was stupid, in my opinion. And I just shut down a lot of it. I denied a lot of it. The few things I thought were acceptable, like, we sort of did. And that was shocking to Activision, because in their minds, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, no, we can't do this or that. Like, in their minds, they owned, which they legally and technically did, you know, they own everything, right? They own the company. They own the IP. Like, there's no reason why they can't get exactly what they want. I, being ignorant to any of that, was just like, no, I'm going to do the things that I think are good ideals, and I'm going to decline the things I think are bad ideals. And I didn't know. I feel like somebody who was more well-versed would have went in with these preconceptions and sort of been like, no, I have to do – like, I have to be accommodating to Activision. I did not feel that way. And so I just went in and sort of did what I felt was right for the game and for the player and for us as a studio, because I sort of considered us, like, even though we weren't, I considered us a sort of independent entity that can operate freely as we so choose. And so that's how I sort of acted. And Vince and Jason West, who was the, you know, other co-founder of Infinity Ward at the time, loved it. Like, they're like, this is incredible. We no longer have to do all the stuff we don't want to do. And they were, I mean, you know, not that they, you know, really did anything they didn't want to, but they didn't even have to deal with the hassle, right? Like, they're pretty strong-willed people. And so that's sort of just how I fell into it. And because of that, because I sort of, like, became that public-facing face for Call of Duty and our studio and Infinity Ward and the team, not just to the players, but also to Activision and any other third party that we worked with, I sort of just sort of kept assuming more and more responsibility and stuff that I was sort of, like, looking at. And that sort of transition from just being focused on our game and being more, like, franchise focused, as you know, as it became a billion-dollar franchise and there were multiple studios involved, and lots of press and lots of investor relation responsibilities, like, that just sort of accumulated. But yeah, does that answer the question?
I forgot what the question was.
Well, get used to this, because this is what I do. Like, you will ask the most simple question, and I will give you 10 years of backstory and context.
Well, it's just, we might have to do a couple shows of this. The thing I pulled away is, like, have you ever known in your life what you were doing at any point in time, or do you just never do stuff?
I am an aimless, like, I have things I want to do, and that is really the only motivating factor. But 99% of the things I actually do, I jump in completely blind, no clue what I'm doing, because, like, I feel like, well, I don't feel like you need that. That's not a universal statement. I don't think everybody needs that. Some people work very well with preparation and research. I am the opposite. I am much more like, I need to feel like I am drowning, because otherwise I'm too lazy to fight for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If I feel like I have, this has to work. Like, I have, like, I moved to LA. I moved everything I had in a Ford Focus, drove it across the country. I had to start it with a screwdriver because the starter was, like, the ignition was all jacked up. And I got there. I didn't have, you know, much money. I had the money that I, you know, made from the magazine and the record label. And until I started getting paid from Infinity Ward, I was like, man, this has to work. Like, I'm not leaving LA without this working. And that's sort of been the case for everything that I've done. It's like, just dive in, and if you feel like you're going to die, then your survival instinct will kick in. And
I like your dying thing a lot, because that really that really exemplifies what this is, at least mentally, and the strain it takes to be able to be your own boss and in the entertainment business and all these things where you're doing a lot of things in the independent nature of a business. But man, I tell them, just like, throw yourself in the fire and just try not to burn. Like, figure it out, man. Because you're gonna suck for a while. And then one day, if you're good, you won't suck. And people will start to pay you money. And that's really how everything works. And it seemingly worked a lot faster for you than a lot of other folks. Because you got paid a lot very quickly. And then, okay, that's good. I'm going to jump into something completely different. Drive to California with a screwdriver in my ignition. And figure out how to make video games. And then you did. And it became a very successful 6-year run that produced very, very popular games that people still play on their Xbox 360s in their bedroom. That would be me. Did it ever get crippling at any points?
Crippling, I would say no, only because I've kept going and I'm still doing it, right? Like Midnight Society was another big like dive into like, okay, let's try this thing. But like, yeah, I mean, you always have those moments where you're like, especially, you know, when things fail, right? And like the advice I like to give people, which is exactly what you said, is like, just jump in and do it, right? Just start doing it, because in the best case scenario, it is successful and you make something that's worth billions of dollars, right? Which happened in my case. I got to be a part of something that grew massively into a billion-dollar franchise. That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, it goes terrible, it makes nothing, and it's a right? But the good thing about that is if you fail so bad that like it's just not sustainable and you have to move on, the odds are that nobody even noticed. Because if they did notice, it wouldn't be, you know, unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So that thing's going to fail and no one's going to ever know it's existed. And the few people who knew it existed are going to forget about it because it was so unoriginal or unspecial, right? And so what did you lose? You lost time and you lost, you know, a little bit of your ego, but that's it. So if you look at the span of my career, I am associated with like, I think 25 to 30 video games. You could probably name 5 of them, right?
Right.
Like, yeah. Because the other ones, which were all great games, but they were like, they were as big as they needed to be. You know, when I was vice president at Humble Bundle, we published a bunch of games that were great games. They're just smaller in scope and they have a niche audience and most people are never going to know about them or play them. And that's okay. Right. Like they weren't ever meant to be massive IPs or franchises or anything like that. Like they served a purpose. There's some indie games, some indie mobile games that I developed or published or funded, right? Because I've done a lot of like funding of other people's games. And those games, like they had a nice audience. They had a nice little run of like a couple years. Like one of those is Breach and Clear, which I did with Wes and Gun Interactive out of Kentucky. That was a great game. They ended up selling it. I forget who bought it, but they ended up selling it. It was the number one strategy game on iOS for a while. But most people are not going to know about that game. And so like that's really sort of like what I think about and what stops it from being like crippling anxiety is like I have really leaned into the belief, not the belief that everything happens for a reason, but the belief that like everything like has its place and not everything has to be a massive success. Like just the fact, like I feel like it's a success if you just get it out the door, because as I'm sure you know, like dealing with creative endeavors, just getting something to the finish line is hard enough. Oh. Like that's step one. It's just like manifesting something from nothing and then having it exist in the world where other people can access it. That is the monumental task. And then the second monumental task is making people aware of it and hopefully like it. So like I benefit from the fact that I really enjoy that making something from nothing stage of it. And I actually enjoy less the monumental success. Like, the reason, like, I resigned from Infinity Ward. Like, I quit. I left millions of dollars on the table. Like, literally, I was supposed to get another $1 million check in royalties in, like, August, like, towards the end of the year that I left. And I quit before I got it because I wasn't feeling it anymore. Like, from an emotional, mental work standpoint. And I paid for that, literally and figuratively, right? But to me, it was the right thing to do because I don't enjoy that stage. I don't enjoy the stage that I was in Call of Duty where we could literally in a box and make $1 billion.
Right.
Now, and like, that's the sad reality is like, we were at the point of like, we could make the worst game in the world, but you're guaranteed to get the pre-orders because the previous games were so good. And so the challenge is gone. You know, like the fun of why you're doing it is gone because you're like, literally, I don't have to be good and I can still make the same amount of money, which unfortunately Activision has continued to do for a while now. Like, they quality has slipped.
Oh, I got a question about that later on. I guess we're already here. I guess we can go to it now. You've been very outspoken about Call of Duty's downward spin into microtransactions and leaving the gamer out of the loop when it comes to improving the game. What is your take on Activision and the way that this has gone with Call of Duty in particular?
That is a huge question.
Yeah, it's a question you've been very active about on Twitter, so I figured you might have some thoughts.
I am very like targeted with my criticism on Call of Duty because I want to be like. And it's hard, like, especially on Twitter. Like, sometimes I hurt a lot of people's feelings who work on the franchise because, like, they take it the wrong way. Obviously, if you spend a lot of time and effort and emotional energy creating something, like, you don't want people talking bad about it at all, right? So I'm very sensitive to that. And generally, I am not referring to, like, the individual contributions and work or quality of 99% of the game, right? Like, if you look at it, the game looks better than it's ever looked, right? Like, visually, the art is better. Technically, what they've been able to do with the engine, like, the fact that they're still modifying and building upon the modified Quake 3 engine that we started with and haven't switched to some more full-featured engine, like, they've built all of that on top of it, is an engineering, like, you know, masterpiece. The fact that they were even able to do something like Warzone, like, the amount of new tech they had to build just to do that is incredible, right? So let's just say that first. And a lot of the issues that I have with it come from the top down, right? It came from the previous Activision leadership because, for, you know, the listener, like, Activision just got acquired by Microsoft. It is now wholly owned by Microsoft. A lot of the toxic leadership is gone. And they're introducing like Microsoft leadership into it. So things are changing and I am hopeful for the better. But like, to get to that point in between the original Modern Warfare series and that acquisition by Microsoft, like, there's been tons of stuff that just is, it just is the case. And I remember the moment that it was going to be the downfall. And we had shipped it's Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare. So this would have been like 2007, like maybe Christmas 2007. Okay. Just to put you mentally in that space.
I was 7. It was great.
Yeah. So Christmas time 2007, we had shipped Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare. It was incredible. Like back in those days, I would spend like 12, 13 hours a day at the studio working. And then I would go home and play our game, Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, until like 4 a.m. and then try to get some sleep and then show back at the office at the studio at like 10 a.m. And then do it all over again. Like, I was in it. Like, I was all in as a player, as a fan, as somebody working on it. Like, it was an emotional thing to me. It was not just a pastime. So I cared very deeply about the game and about my fellow community and all of that stuff. And I remember we had our Infinity Ward Christmas party, And we're there, and like, you know, the whole team's there, and some Activision people are there, and Bobby Kotick's there, and I'm like chatting with Bobby Kotick, who, for again, listener, is the is it annoying if I give context?
No, no, go for it.
Bobby Kotick was the CEO of Activision, which is the publisher of Call of Duty. So he was there, and we were chatting. It was just a casual conversation, and he was, you know, congratulating us on the success. It's like, oh wow, it's so many players. It's going really good. You know, great job, guys. Which was a very nice thing to say. Very nice conversation. And then he went into this like thing about like, oh, but you know what would be really great? And this is not verbatim. I'm paraphrasing here. Like, I'm not quoting him exactly, but you know, he's like, what would be really great is if we could get them to like continue to pay money. So like right now they pay $60 for the game and they get to play it forever. Yeah. But what if we had ways to sell them more stuff to where they had to keep paying for, you know, over and over again? And what he was referring to, which we all know very well now, is just microtransactions, right? Like, oh, we can sell you different costumes. We can sell you weapon skins. We can whatever. And I'm not opposed to the concept of microtransactions or cosmetics in general. Like, I'm a, like, you know, to me, they're digital action figures now, right? I grew up playing with a lot of action figures. I collect, you know, Kenner series Star Wars figures. I loved playing with action figures as a kid. So, like, I am that demographic, right? Like, to me, it has just switched over to digital. All my skins in Fortnite are just action figures in my mind. So I'm not opposed to the concept, but sort of like, I feel like it needs to be an organic thing that feels right for the game. And you need to always be thinking about, how does this improve and enhance my player's experience or connection to the game, right? And the direction that he was coming from was purely a monetization like focus of like, how can we make more money off the same people, right? And that felt gross to me for a lot of reasons, because like what I like about, because his sort of approach was like, hey, I want to sell you a $60 game in Call of Duty, and then I want to sell you all this other stuff that you need to fully enjoy the game, right? It's like, oh, you have to buy these maps, and if you don't buy the maps, you don't get to matchmake with your friends. It's like, well, that sucks. Right. Like, that's not an option, right? Which they did for a short amount of time, and then luckily we got that change. And then it's like, oh, we're going to buy all these, you know, you have to buy all these other additional things. Now, luckily the industry sort of went in a way where we introduced free-to-play. And I think free-to-play is an incredible introduction, because it's not about, like, if you optionally want to buy in a lot of stuff, that's great. You have the option to do it. But if you just want to play for free, you can, right? That's a different approach than what he was talking about, which is like, pay $60 to buy the game and then pay more.
Right.
To keep enjoying the game. And that is the part that feels real bad to me.
Just as an example of free to play, that'd be like Warzone.
Yes,
for people not up to this. Right.
But if you'll notice, what most companies do is Warzone is the game. Like, you look at Fortnite Battle Royale is the game. And now, yes, they have the additional Save the World mode that you can buy, but nobody does. But it's like, play Fortnite Battle Royale, and then if you want to buy skins, you can. And Call of Duty had went the way where it's like, oh, pay $60, $70, $120 if you want to buy the deluxe digital edition of Call of Duty, and then also have all these other things that you have to buy or can buy, you know? And so, like, I would be less offended if they went the full free-to-play route, like Warzone, where it's like, hey, no, it's just play it, have fun, and if you want to buy the additional cosmetics, do that.
Right.
instead of the double dipping of, like, I'm going to sell you a premium experience, and I'm going to put a battle pass on top of it, and I'm going to put microtransaction cosmetics on top of it, and I'm going to have, you know, this subscription stuff with it.
No, I fully understand. And I agree with you, because it's the very classic art versus commerce, right? Like, this is a form of art. This is game development. This is entertainment. This is something that people enjoy. And then you have people that want to, okay, that's really fun. How can we make billions of dollars off of these people? And it's been like that in music. It's been like that in sports. It's becoming a larger issue, at least to the public, in gaming. And I get why you left Infinity Ward, and I get what you're doing now with Midnight Society, and I appreciate people like you who are in the gaming industry that care about people like me. We're like, I just want to hang out, man. Like, this is something I get to do where I'm not working the 10 or 12 hours of the day that I do. Like, I just want to sit here and enjoy myself, even if just for an hour, and play the game that I paid for without having, hey, here's, you want this thing for $5, you want this thing for 20, you want this thing for all these coins. Like, I just, I'm good, man. I just want to play. It just bogs down the casual gamer.
It's a balance. And like, the thing is, like, as somebody who currently owns a video game studio who's making a major first-person shooter and who has made, you know, Call of Duties in the past, like, I understand that it is a business and we have to make money, right? Because, you know, Call of Duty takes over, you know, with dev budget and marketing budget, over $100 million to produce. That's a big risk. It's massive, you know, to risk. Put in over $100 million into a thing and have to recoup that money. But it's all about finding a balance and finding the right approach to how do you work with your community to make money and to make something compelling that is enhancing their experience and not something that is just creating pain points so that you can sell them the solution to that pain point, or creating unnecessary monetization just for increased greed, right? Like, let's find that balance, because I am definitely not anti-capitalism, but I am fair and reasonable capitalism.
Right.
Which is a very hard balance to strike, especially when you're already making the money. That is when it's hard to have character, is when you're like, look at this. The money just keeps increasing. The line is going up. So why would you want that to go down, you know? And it's like, well, it's because sometimes you need to value things other than pure monetary value. You have to value things like retention. Like, I would rather have somebody pay me a reasonable amount of money every year and stick with me for decades than I would somebody drop, you know, $100 and then get burnt out because they just feel like they're on a treadmill of constantly have to pay more money and then never play the game again.
Right.
Which is where I'm at with Call of Duty. Like, I currently do not have a Call of Duty installed on any of my hardware, which is kind of sad. Like, I wish that I felt like that was a franchise that I could still sort of emotionally be engaged with.
And the, and like, I played all three of the Modern Warfare reboots. I understand wanting to chase nostalgia, but instead of giving me something new and fresh with this very nice and lovely coat of paint that you threw on it, it feels like you're just chasing ghosts of the last couple of years where you guys made better games. And like, it just, I get frustrated with it, because I want it to be as good as I remember it being. And it's frustrating, and it's almost disheartening to sit there and like, this is not great. Like, it's fine. It's just not very good. And I could be spending my $60 to $70 somewhere else and playing something better. I could play something like Dead Drop that comes out very soon, I'm assuming.
Exactly. And you want to know the irony of that?
What's up? Tell me.
Is the a lot of the motivations, not entirely the motivations, right? Like, there was narrative reasons for doing this, but a lot of the emotional motivations to killing off characters like Ghost and Soap and stuff was so that Activision couldn't continue to monetize those characters once we were all gone. And yet they found a way to do it.
Yeah.
By rebooting the franchise, introducing them as skins and multiplayer, which I don't know if you realize this, if most people realize this, but we didn't include single player characters in multiplayer for a reason, right? But now, like, the fact that you can have, like, a bunch of soaps, a bunch of ghosts, a bunch of whatever running around because they know those skins will sell in multiplayer, like, those are the little things I'm talking about, right? It's like, yeah. we made a decision of, like, hey, we don't want them to appear in multiplayer because we want multiplayer to be about you as the player embodying soldiers and then playing, and it doesn't need to mix with the narrative stuff.
Right.
You know, keep the narrative sacred, keep it pure. It's the same reason we didn't have zombies in our game. It's like, no, we are telling, you know, a story about the military industrial complex, about, you know, our role in conflicts internationally, about the role of camaraderie and teamwork and all of that stuff, right? Like, there's narrative there that's being built, and we don't want to dilute that by having, you know, five Captain Prices and three ghosts and two soaps and a bunch of gazes running around shooting each other. That's like just one of those little nuanced lines that I'm talking about. As like, once you realize, like, oh no, narrative reason, we could sell these for $20 a piece. So let's do it. It's like, no, don't just do it. You could make the same amount of money by just making a cool original skin. Like, just like have a line. Have a line of, like, you know, just self-control to, like, have a principle. And that's the stuff that drives me crazy.
Is there a way back?
Of course. Of course there is. Like, if I rejoined Infinity War tomorrow, there's a million things that I would institute that just sort of bring us back to center. Bring us back to, like, you know, having some guiding principles and some guidelines and some focus. But the thing is, it's going to hit the bottom line. Not in a terrible way, right? It's not like I'm trying to be like, oh, we don't monetize our game anymore. But it's definitely is going to mess with the projections for the first year, right, after you do it. And that's the reason that I feel like it may not come back. Because, you know, how capitalism works is executives of for-profit companies have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to maximize profits, period. That is their purpose. Their purpose is not to make the best game. Their purpose is not – that's the game developer's purpose, right? Like Infinity Ward, the game developer individual, their purpose is to make the game best game possible, right? That right. is not the purpose of whoever owns and sells the video game and IP. So that is the part where it's – but I do have hope with the new Microsoft acquisition, because Microsoft has been known to make decisions that are more about, like, hey, let's do what's right for our user base, not just the best. Because there, you know, it's a harder case to make, but there are ways – like if you have goodwill – with your community, you can turn that into more profit,
right?
If done correctly, because you bring, you know, you bring people like me who have left the franchise back. I don't mean as a worker; I mean as a player, right? You bring people like me back. We're now re-engaged. We're willing to buy a battle pass. We're willing to buy one or two skins, opposed to now where I don't even have.
It's a line that we have to figure out where to draw it again. On, again, it's a business. We understand that this has to make money because people have to have jobs. But ultimately, like, we're a video game company and we are making a bad video game. Where does the moral meet the money? Which has always been the question for a lot of these things. So I appreciate people like you, again, who are keeping people like me in mind. That, like, I just want to play a game that I like. Hopefully Microsoft and all of their money fix the problems, which I think it's pretty ironic that Microsoft having a bunch of money and maybe able to, because even sacrificing money is, I don't think the project's going to have to sacrifice money if it's any good, right?
Yeah,
people are going to come right back to it.
They are in a position to diversify,
right?
So they've already announced that all the Call of Duties are coming to Game Pass, which is great because it means that they are relying on you subscribing to Game Pass, not you buying things in game, right? So that already gives them an out to where they can sort of be less aggressive on the in-game monetization because they've already sort of monetized Game Pass. So that's my hope, is that when Call of Duty becomes part of us, not that it's limited to Game Pass, right? It's not like you have to buy Game Pass to buy it. But I think that gives them a little bit more leverage to make more consumer-conscious decisions about their monetization practices moving forward, is the most PR way I can answer that.
If I learned anything about you, Robert, it's you're very, very PR.
Yeah, I can be.
Well, you had to learn how to be because, you know, business. One thing I actually wanted to talk about with you, I feel really bad. It's 50 minutes into the show. You actually work, you know, on a game right now, and you are a studio head of a place where you actually work. We've talked about Activision and Infinity Ward for the last couple of minutes. I just want to talk about Midnight Society. I want to talk about Dead Drop. I want to talk about the things you're currently doing before I actually let you go. Because if people have stuck around this long, they deserve to hear about what Robert is doing now rather than all of the experiences and all of his opinions of the past. So, Midnight Society, brand new gaming studio. What was the process like to build this thing amidst all of the excitement? Because people, like I said earlier in the show, know who you are in the gaming industry, and obviously you have some very famous partners. So what was the building process like at the company?
Yeah, so I had moved away from development a little bit. So in the sense of, like, I wasn't hands-on trying to develop games anymore. I had moved over. I was doing a lot of funding. I was investing in game studios. I was investing in game ideas. Indies, developers, people would come to me and they'd be like, "Hey, I got an idea for this." I'd be like, "Oh, that sounds really cool." Like, you know, help them sort of start a company, fund it, give them the capital to sort of get it started, get it out the door, that sort of stuff, right? So a lot more sort of involved in the development of games but more on the publishing investment side of it. And that was like for several years, right? From like, I was the head of publishing at Humble Bundle. I started a mobile publishing company called The Label. And then I had a investment fund for game developers called The Incubator. And so I was doing all of that stuff for several years. And, was pretty happy. Was pretty content doing that, right? Just helping other people make their dreams a reality. And then, a buddy of mine, who is known as Dr. Disrespect, who's very popular video game YouTuber. So we worked together back on Modern Warfare 3. So I don't know how many people know this. He talks about it on his stream sometimes. But he was a level designer on Modern Warfare 3. He made a lot of the multiplayer maps for Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. So that is how we met originally. It's back towards the end of Modern Warfare 2 and then all of Modern Warfare 3. And then I ended up leaving Activision at the end of shortly after Modern Warfare 3. We were working on DLC for Modern Warfare 3. And that's when I resigned. He stuck around and did some more Call of Duty. And so we had met then and become friends and, you know, all of that. And then all the Dr. Disrespect stuff took off. He built this whole empire with that. And then he, very much like myself, is very forthcoming with his opinions and is very passionate about what he likes and what he doesn't like. And we were both generally just tired of what the industry was doing, especially in the first-person shooter space, and like just was very opinionated about how it could be done. And fortunately for us, we are also people who will put our money where our mouth is, right? We're not just going to sit on the sidelines and talk shit and just be opinionated to be opinionated's sake. We were like, you know what, let's just do it the way that we think it should be done. Now, the only reason we hadn't done it up until that point is because I had deliberately not wanted to work on a first-person shooter since leaving Call of Duty, because once you make something that is hugely successful and very popular and well-known, whether you're trying to or not, you're competing with that. You're competing with what people know that you can do. And making a game the rival Call of Duty, not to say that's what we're intentionally trying to do, but to make a game that is going to be perceived that way requires a lot of money. It requires, literally, I would need to dedicate my entire life to it, right? Like, I would have to, like, not be doing a bunch of side stuff. I can't be investing in a bunch of other studios. Like, it would become my core focus for the next 10 years of my life. That's a big commitment, right? And so when Doc had the idea to start Midnight Society, and like we started talking about it with him and our other co-founder Sumit, I was like we were talking about it and talking about it, and I literally called them, and Sumit tells this story all the time. Like, we were on a, like, another call about it, and I was like, guys, are we doing this? Like, are we doing this or are we not doing this? And that was like the moment where we're like, okay, yes, we'll do it. Like, all right, fine, we'll do it. We'll do it for real. And then I was like, all right, well, if we're doing it, like, let's announce it. Like, let's tell people we're doing it. Let's launch the website. Let's get people involved, all of that stuff. And so that's what we did. And that was like, what, over 2 years ago now. It was just the end of 2021. Is that correct? I think so.
Sounds right and correct to me.
Yeah. And so we just launched it. And the key thing with Midnight Society, like the sort of guiding principles for that, is we want to do it 100% transparency. We don't want to be behind a closed door designing something for years and then we release it and then you guys are like, oh, that kind of sucks. Right? It's right. Like if we did that, it's solely our fault. What I wanted to do and what we collectively decided to do was we are going to release playable versions of the game all the way from the moment that one weapon's in there, right? If we have a weapon and an environment and a character you can control, you can play the game.
Mm-hmm.
You can download early builds, and then we'll continue to build it in public in front of you. And you can play it, and you can get feedback, and you can tell us what sucks and what isn't good, and I'm going to listen to it. And we're going to test everything with our players, from the gameplay to the visuals to the monetization. Like, we've already monetized the game, right? Like, we did a thing called a driver's key where you could buy legendary vehicle skins and like whatever as like a test, right? And then also it came with these a bonus to buying those skins came with like these exotic crates where it was like a mystery bag of like, oh, you get one of like 100 cosmetics, right? Because like, we really like how the knife crates work in CSGO. That was the motivation behind it, right? And even though they were a bonus for buying the things, that was the only way that you could get the crates, right? And our players almost instantaneously, some of them, not all of them, but some of them instantaneously were like, hey, it kind of sucks that the only way I can get that bonus is if I buy the skin, because I've been playing the game since you've been releasing builds, and there's no way for me to get those cosmetics. And that kind of sucks. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can kind of see that point. That does kind of suck, you know? And then we built in the ability for you to earn those same crates by completing challenges in the game. And it was like – and then they're like, oh, cool. Like, yeah, the people who want to guarantee that they get it just buy the things.
Yeah.
And the people who just want to invest their time. And awesome. If we did it the old way – that feature would not exist.
Yeah.
Because we would have just been designing a thing. It's like, oh, here's how we make money and like blah, blah, blah. And we would have released it. And if you were in that camp where you're like, hey, I don't want to drop $20 for this thing, but I do want the thing. Can I support you in another way? And that is sort of like our guiding principle is like, hey, we do not have all the right answers. We have strong opinions, and let's test those opinions and then be active listeners and find out where we're wrong. Poke holes in it. Tell us where we can improve it, and then we will improve it, because we're not making a game for ourselves. We are making a game for everybody else who shares our interests. And so we need to listen to everybody else. And so that's how it's got started, and that's how we've been doing it for 2 years. And like, now we're at the point where we're in like heavy production, right? Because like, the one downside to releasing things as you build them is they're ugly.
Right.
You know, like, because you're not, you know, you're releasing it as you finish the code side. And it's unarted. It's like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen a game that isn't finished, but it's like what we call white box or gray boxings.
Yeah.
It's like white box environments. Nothing has textures on it. It looks like and you have to put what we call your developer goggles on to see where it's going. But it doesn't matter when you're a developer because you're just testing things like movement. Like, does this run feel good? Does this slide feel good? Does these gadgets that I'm using feel good? Like, you're doing the core gameplay loops. It's all about feel. It's not about looks. But normal players aren't used to seeing games like that, right? So that's the only downside. And now we're at the point 2 years in that we are fleshing out all the visuals of it, like doing all the art, making sure the characters look good, the environments look good, all the cosmetics are cool, like all of that stuff. So it's been fun.
And the reason I have experience with that is, we've been doing a lot of like journalistic work on the new college football game that EA Sports is putting out, right? Their first one in 11 years or so. And the game itself is done, but they have to go in and polish it up because it's, you know, like you said, ugly. And yeah, to just see like screen grabs of what playing just a normal game, like an exhibition game or whatever. And like that all looks really great. And then you look at it compared to something like Madden, where Madden's like obviously finished and polished and everything's done. It's like, I don't think I have the eye to see where this is going. Did anyone have any reservations to this idea?
The artists always do because they're going to be the ones who get most during this early stage because people don't always know that it's supposed to look that way at this stage, right? So like, and so the artists always have that hesitation of like, people are going to think I'm bad at my job if they see it at this stage, right? It's sort of like if a painter is painting a painting and you came in and assigned a value and judgment to it when they're like 25% in.
Right.
Right? Like, have you ever seen a painting 25% in? It's like, it doesn't look like anything. And then you come back a few weeks later and you're like, oh, wow, that's like an incredible scene, you know? And so there's always hesitation amongst whatever. And like, that is why communication is so key. So like, we decided early on to release this thing called the Variant Guide. Variants is what we called our like first group of players. And like, the Variant Guide is literally like, think about like, you know, did you ever subscribe to Nintendo Power?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So, you know, back in the day when Nintendo first came to America, the NES, the Super Nintendo, all of that, Nintendo had an official magazine called Nintendo Power, and you could subscribe to it, and you would get updates on the games that are in development for the consoles, and you could see, like, you know, screenshots, and, like, you know, you get yourself hyped up about it and learn about it before the game actually came out. And so we designed a variant guide, a magazine that would continue to expand every single time we released the build. And the goal of that magazine was just to educate the people who were interested in the process of like, hey, here is what we're making now. Here's what it looks like. Here's what it's eventually going to look like, right? We'll show them like the crappy in-game art that exists now, and then we would show them the concept art so that they could see point A and point Z. So that they had a little bit more context when they're playing to be like, oh, yeah, it looks like this now, but that's only because X, Y, and Z doesn't exist yet.
Right.
And so we had to put a lot of effort into just creating that context for people so that they understood and could be like, could look at it a little bit more how a developer would look at it. And that helped sort of dispel a lot of the hesitations and anxiety. And then we started doing in-person events. Like we like partnered with Optic Gaming in Texas at the Optic Arena and like put on a huge show for Snapshot 5. And I think once the team came there and saw hundreds of people lined up outside to get in and like experience it for the first time, like that was like, oh wow. Like there are like-minded people like us out there who are willing to play something that's raw and ugly and like unfinished because they're passionate about getting it right at the finish line. Right, they don't need that instant gratification. They want to be part of the process. They want to get their hands dirty and like watch something evolve rather than just wait till it's finished and then complain about it.
What?
And finishes in quotations.
Right. It's almost like they're a part of the team, right?
They are. They 100% are.
it's this growing with the game. You're watching it grow up. You're watching it kind of, you know, figure out what it is. And that's got to be incredibly rewarding for the people that are there right at the jump. Those people are going to be fans of whatever you guys do next. It's not something I've ever heard before in really any industry. And I wish you guys all the success in the world.
Yeah. It's been fun. And I honestly cannot imagine making a game any other way now. Like, I cannot imagine what it's like to work on something for years in secret and nobody get to see it.
Right.
Or know about it or get feedback on it. You know, because I've done that. And, like, a lot of those games never ship because of whatever reason, right? Funding backs out or, like, you know, there's a million reasons, like, a game can die in development. But I feel like you decrease the odds of that happening when it's a known thing that's out there and you can rally support around it and you can show, like, our ability to show investors metrics of, like, look, here's how many people are playing. Here's how long their average session is. Like, it's better than average, right? Like having that data to point to, like, helps you sort of not rely on. Because, like, normally when you're making a game in secret, like, you're just asking people to trust you, right? You're like, it's going to be good. Trust me. Like, I just need $50 million and I promise it'll be great. Which is an insane proposition.
It doesn't work in any other industry. That never works at any other thing. It's like, hey, just give me $50 million in 2 years. You'll see.
Trust me, 4 million people are going to buy it. I can guarantee it. Where this, we can sort of like build it, show people, like see, like, oh, like, see, there's interest. Like the fact that, you know, 300 people flew out to LA and flew out to Texas and flew out to Vegas for these in-person unveilings is a meaningful thing to show, right? Showing that these people, they could be playing any other game right now and they're putting X amount of hours into Dead Drop, even though it's unfinished. Like, that is meaningful data and that's a meaningful thing to us as developers. And they're like, hey, we're doing something right. Let's just keep doing that.
Right. It's, man, I can't be happier for you guys and the success that you've had so far and just the development of the game. It sounds like you got people to care about your game. And really, that's all you could ever ask for. Because like you said, there are so many games that have been made, right? Like, there are millions of options out there for folks to spend their time doing, to spend their time playing. And they're choosing you guys. And that's got to be a rewarding feeling for the staff and for the people that have played this game since day one, that this community is getting bigger, that these people that are in charge of it are people that genuinely care about if you have a good time with this or not. And they're not going to try to steal your money. I love the concept. Again, I wish you all the success in the world. I have still a million questions more, but we're already out of time. I certainly appreciate it. Robert, I would love to have you back on very soon to finish up kind of the interview that I had in mind.
Yeah. Well, I'm around. So if this episode does great, then I'll happily come back. If this episode tanks, you will never hear my voice again.
Well, I'll certainly keep the numbers to myself to to get you back on.
When I don't know, I can't make a decision if I don't know data.
By the way, for those who are still listening from like minute one to minute now, whatever it is, Piner, Kentucky, elevation 276 feet. That's a lot coming from my home here in Louisiana. And there are six sentences about it on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Good for you guys.
It's all about a tornado, probably.
Yeah, two of them. Two of the sentences.
Two of the six sentences.
My favorite sentence in this whole thing is Piner has an elementary school, Piner Elementary School, which is a part of the Kenton. Is that right? Kenton County School District. Yep. That's it. It has an elementary school. Congratulations, Piner, Kentucky.
You did it.
Robert, this was awesome, man.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun. I'm excited to listen to the rest of the episodes.
Thank you so much for your time. You can find him on the internet. We had notes pulled up, but I pulled up Piner, Kentucky instead. So we'll add it in at post. You were very popular on the internet. So people, if they listen to you right now, they're probably going to find you. And it's at 402, actually spelled out, 4 with the U, 02. Thank you so much to Robert for his time. Thank you so much to you for listening. For Robert Bowling, I'm Riley James, if anyone cares.